The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Today we're talking about medical history in extremes, looking both at our successes and advancement, as well as our failures and wrong turns. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Today we're looking backwards into the history of medicine, both how it's connected to human exploration and also how we sometimes got it horribly wrong. Later on, I'll talk with Dr. Sydney McElroy and her husband Justin McElroy, hosts of the podcast Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine, about the many ways we've done medicine badly in human history. But first, I'm here with Dr. Kevin Fong. He holds degrees in medicine, astrophysics and engineering, and is an honorary senior lecturer in physiology at University College London. He has completed specialist training in anesthesia and intensive care medicine, has worked with NASA, and is the founder of the Center for Altitude, Space, and Extreme Environment Medicine. Kevin has created and starred in several documentaries for the BBC and Radio 4 in the UK, writes for The Guardian, and has a regular column in the Times Higher Educational Magazine. He's here today to talk about his new book, Extreme Medicine: How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
So how did you make the connection between medical advancement and human exploration?
Well, I mean, it was mainly because, you know, I think there was this sort of these two narratives that went on. You know, there was, on the one hand, there was sort of the way we saw physical exploration, in which people advanced sort of stumbling forwards into the unknown, hoping that survival and good fortune lay in wait. And then there was the way we told medicine, which was, you know, as this sort of plodding, inductive progress that stepwise just got better and better over time. And we did one thing, then we did another thing, and another great thing happened, and so on and so forth. And actually, as I looked certainly at the history of 20th century medicine, I came to realize that wasn't the case, and that, in fact, the things that we did in the 20th century, the medical innovations, were as much feats of exploration of the human body as our forays into the physical world were. So that was really where it came from. You know, I'm interested in both, and I came to see the parallels, I think, between both of them.
It's really interesting, because when you say that we sort of see medicine as the discovery of medicine, modern medicine, as a very linear thing, it's really true. We sort of see it as a straight line, a very obvious connecting dot. But reading your book, it's really clear that a lot of times we were kind of staggering around.
I think that that's the way it is, because I think that all science is at heart exploratory, and that we shouldn't be surprised, really, that when we innovate in medicine, that tends to be exploratory in nature. It's part of sort of, you know, medics get great PR. You know, they're sort of, no one ever questions really very hard what they do in the modern paradigm. You know, mostly it's seen as a force for good, and that's what it is at heart. It's a profession which is trying to do good for people. But that doesn't stop us having these moments of uncertainty, both in our daily lives, but also as the art progresses. And that was kind of what I wanted to tease out, that these moments where people were in medicine and in physical exploration confronted with a challenge, you know, asked to leap off into the unknown, and what the consequences of that were. And I think that there are, you know, many examples. You know, throughout the book we talk about lots of different examples through the 20th century. So whether it was the onset of reconstructive plastic surgery, which came out of, you know, World War II air war, whether it was heart surgery, which was also a product of the Great War and World War II, or whether it was, say, something more recent, intensive care, which came out of us grappling with the epidemics of polio in the middle of the 20th century. And I wanted to recast medicine really in the 20th century in that sort of exploratory sense, to make it feel slightly less certain and feel more like the adventure that it really is.
Reading your book, it's really clear that we've learned most of what we know today about human physiology in the last century, and it seems like we didn't really know much before then.
We did know quite a lot about the human body before the 20th century, but it is true to say that lots of our knowledge has developed in the last 100 years, partly because of the ways in which we're able to probe the human body laterally, you know, through the genome, but also through advanced imaging technologies and also other ways of measuring the dynamic systems, the way that the body works together, so the physiology of the body. Prior to that, we had a reasonable sense of the human body, but it was mostly descriptive and it was limited by, you know, the tools we had to hand. And so it's not so much that we hadn't built up a body of knowledge. There was a very good, strong core body of knowledge upon which medicine had been practiced for centuries before. But I think in the 20th century, life starts to happen faster and medicine starts to happen faster. And as our understanding of the complexity of the human body expands, then we're confronted with greater challenge, but also greater possibility, greater capability.
What I also find interesting is how we have taken some very dangerous situations and actually turned them around, and they've become a part of the toolbox for modern medicine. I'm thinking particularly of the chapter on hypothermia.
It's staggering, isn't it, to think that you and I were having this conversation 100 years ago, quite apart from the fact that we wouldn't be having it across a digital line. If we were talking, you know, 1914, we'd still be talking about the unexplored poles of the Earth. So Scott and Amundsen would have just completed their race to the pole, Scott's team having perished, Amundsen's team successful, but the South Pole would have still seemed like a very alien and inaccessible place. We would yet have had to move on into the skies with aviation, really. The Wright brothers' innovation is only a decade old by this point in the 20th century. And you know, forget about space or the deep oceans. We haven't even really begun to go there. And so I find it interesting that 10 short decades ago, the world was full of spaces on the map of the world that were still white, that no one had ever explored, no human footstep had ever trodden. And you know, we looked on into the darkness of space as this great, huge, yawning unknown that we really just had no true concept of. And in the century that intervened, we took it all on. We went across the highest mountains. We went to the South Pole. We went into the deep oceans. We went into the skies. We went onwards into space and continue to do so. And so I think that was what really struck me about it all. And when it comes to hypothermia, you know, those extremes of the human body that you are able to expose people to, you know, we saw it first as threat. We knew that it was something that presented biological hazard to us, and indeed was responsible in large part for killing Scott and his expedition crew when they went to Antarctica. But later on, we came to recognize it as a double-edged sword, actually, something that might both help us and hurt us. And towards the middle of the 20th century, we exploit hypothermia as a tool for allowing us to do cardiac surgery. And right at the end of the 20th century, we have that stunning story of Anna Bagenholm, that legendary tale of survival of a young woman who was trapped underneath the ice in northern Norway and who survives a cardiac arrest that goes on for nearly 3 hours because we exploit the benefits of hypothermia, because we exploit the advantages of it to the human body.
Was this the first time hypothermia was used in this way, or had there been efforts to use it similarly before this story?
So we'd known for quite some time, and it's almost sort of obvious, really, that rates of reaction reduce when things get colder. I mean, you kind of learn that in high school chemistry, don't you? That if a reaction is taking place at a lower temperature, it proceeds more slowly. And so that understanding was exploited in the middle of the 20th century in the early days of heart surgery when we didn't have heart-lung bypass machines. So to operate on somebody, if you wanted to suspend the heart for any period of time, you had to try and find some way of stopping their brain dying of the oxygen starvation while the surgery proceeded. And the way that they did that was they would cool these people down quite dramatically to temperatures of about half of what they are normally. But that was really just, you know, using temperature in a very crude way to try and slow the reaction rates down, to try and reduce the demand for oxygen by the brain. And it worked reasonably well. Now, by the time we're ending, coming towards the end of the 20th century, we're realizing that in any situation in which the heart stops, whether it's during surgery or during a medical catastrophe, as was the case with Anna Bagenholm, that hypothermia might be an advantage. And indeed, when we're resuscitating people, we find that if they are hypothermic, that is, if their temperature is you know, much reduced, that does strangely buy you an extra bit of time before the brain is completely compromised by having been starved of oxygen. And in Anna's case, she's had a cardiac arrest because the cold has stopped her heart. The effects of the cold have caused changes in the ion channels of her heart, so that have caused it to have a cardiac arrest. But at the same time, it's also protected her brain because it's protected it from the effects of oxygen starvation. And so it's not the first time that we did this, but it was the first time it was so extreme. Her core temperature at the point, well, your core temperature right now in degrees Celsius is 37 degrees, plus or minus 0.2 degrees. And her core temperature when she has that accident is 13.7 degrees Celsius. So she is about a third of her normal core temperature, and it's that saves her life.
You're listening to Science for the People. We're talking about medical exploration in the 20th century with Dr. Kevin Fong, author of the new book, Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. The section of your book I found both hardest to read and that contains some of the most fascinating information was actually the chapter on burn treatment. I never really thought of skin as an organ before.
Most people don't think of skin as an organ. And you know, even when you do acknowledge its function, you just think it's just a simple barrier. It's sort of like this waterproof barrier to stop the outside getting in and the inside getting out. But it's just so much more than that. And once you begin to understand it, you sort of see it as this dynamic organ which has both a function in secreting hormones, a very, very fierce protective function, but an immune function as well. It has immune cells crawling over it and through it, really, to try and protect you from you know, the hordes of bacteria that are attacking you from the outside. And once you realize all these things, you have new respect for it. You know, it's this breathable barrier par excellence, you know, the sort of stuff that you spend a lot of money on in the outdoor clothing store that is supposed to be both breathable and waterproof is nothing compared to what skin can do in terms of repelling water but allowing the rest of your body to breathe, for there to be this vapor barrier between you and the outside world. And so once you realize that and you realize how important it is, then you begin to realize how terrible it is as an organ failure of skin being burned. It's a huge failure and one that we in medicine recognize as being very, very hard to recover from.
Most of what we know about modern burn treatment, a lot of it came from World War II and dealing with some of the fighter pilots who flew there. Is that correct?
So that's where modern plastic surgery really takes its root. So, you know, if you trace the history of sort of reconstructive techniques, it goes back actually some centuries. But it's really not until the beginning of the 20th century that we start to think, well, can we actually deliberately use surgery to move uninjured skin from uninjured parts of the body to injured parts of the body to help them regrow a new layer? And so there are some fairly heroic efforts at doing that during World War I, but it's not really until World War II that we see injuries of a scale and a nature that really make it important to develop these new techniques. And so that's interesting in and of itself because, you know, here we see this difficult relationship we have with technology. The technology that produces these horrific injuries on this scale is an aircraft. In fact, specifically, it's the fighter aircraft that are involved in fighting the Battle of Britain. So here's something that you develop to play a role. It's necessary for the air war of World War II, but you build it and it exposes you to greater harm. And in this case, having young pilots sitting on top of high octane fuel, flying into the skies above southern counties of Britain, and having enemy pilots fire incendiary rounds at them, of course people are going to get injured and these people are going to end up parachuting down into their own country, horribly injured but alive, and you've got this massive challenge. What can you do for these people? You've never seen injuries of this type before. You've never seen injuries on this scale before. You've never seen people surviving in this way. And so that challenge then becomes the defining challenge, really, of that period in plastic surgery. And it gives rise to modern plastic surgery. And it's because of that, because of the techniques developed by Archie Mackindo and his team at the East Grinstead Hospital in England, that really gives rise to everything we see around us today that we understand as plastic surgery.
Do you think we would have made as many advances in this kind of extreme medical treatment through the 20th century without World War I and World War II?
So it's difficult, isn't it? Because the natural, where the whole thing starts to look like it's going is that war is in some respects good because it gives us all these wonderful medical advances. And indeed, you can, and I have, pointed to many, many advances that have come as a direct result of war. It's not just burns. It's not just cardiac surgery. It's also other things like trauma management. All of that has been informed by our experience of war. But, you know, you've got to be careful about that interpretation, I think, because what war is, well, what progress is us facing the defining challenge of any given age and mitigating the, almost mitigating the mistakes that we make in any given age. And so in some sense, you can see war as society's biggest mistake and requires its biggest mitigation. And so, you know, that's, I think, why you see war as a recurrent theme in innovation in medicine, because it's a mitigation for this huge, huge challenge. And that mitigation is met with massive resource. So I think that it's a forcing function. I think war is a forcing function for innovation in lots of fields, but particularly medicine. And I think that there are lots of things that we wouldn't possibly have had so quickly if it hadn't been for the experience of war in the 20th century. But as one of my medical historian colleagues points out, he says, well, what you have to do is the other side of the equation, which is, what do you lose in the prosecution of war in the first place? So in World War I, many, many, many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives. And you know, all of those lost lives, I mean, who knows what they might have discovered and built and gone on to innovate themselves. All those relationships between the continental laboratories and the laboratories in the UK, all of those broken relationships, what do you lose? And so whether or not war is equal to the innovation it yields is, you know, a question that will keep the historians busy forever.
You're tuned in to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and with me is Dr. Kevin Fong, and we're talking about the advancement of medical history through the last century and his book, Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. I want to talk a little bit about transplant medicine, because you hear a lot about people donating and why it's important to donate and the lives it saves. But one of the things we don't get a lot of information about in the general public is the actual process and how quickly everything has to happen. So can you walk us through the process of transplants, basically once the donor dies to the time that sort of after it gets transplanted?
I don't really know what the numbers are for North America, but for in the United Kingdom, there are 1,000 people a year who die waiting for an organ that never comes. And so that number must scale up quite dramatically when you think of the whole of the continent of North America. And so it's important, I think, that people understand the process and you know, understand it well enough that when, if that situation arises, that they should be able to, you know, make a rational decision about whether or not they're happy to be an organ donor. Now, there are many ways to donate organs, some of which need you to have organs that have been donated shortly after death has been declared, either the cessation of beating of the heart or a brainstem death, in which the heart may be intact and the lungs may be intact, but that the brain itself is so damaged that no consciousness remains. So in that situation, the next of kin are approached and asked whether or not they believe that their next of kin would have been prepared to be a donor. And if consent is given, then the organs are used for a variety of purposes. So we always think about hearts and lungs and kidneys, but there are other tissues that are useful. Skin itself is useful. Corneas are very useful and can be used even much more distant from the cessation of life itself. And once that happens, then, but for the vital organs, it's quite a rush. So for the heart, for the lungs, particularly, but also to a lesser degree for the liver and for the kidneys, you have hours really, and only a few hours. I mean, for the most oxygen requiring, so metabolically active organs, you have maybe 4 hours. And so that's why it happens so quickly, and that's why it has to be so immediate. And when you see these, when you see an organ donation happening, it is, you know, lots of teams arrive from lots of places and go on to take these organs to help other people. And having been on the end of that, having worked on a neurosurgical intensive care unit where we were often in the situation where we were helping with these sort of donation programs, you know, one of the most amazing things for us was that, you know, you'd forget about what had happened that night. You'd go home, it had been a bad night. But a few weeks later, you'd get a letter from the transplant service that would tell you, thank you for your help, and would tell you how many people's lives had been made possible as a result of that one lost life. And that doesn't make it okay, but it sort of, you realize the purpose of all and the importance of it all.
So when it comes to transplants, because there's so little time, you talk about hours, are there sort of special teams that stand by, kind of ready to descend?
That's exactly right. So for hearts and lungs and livers and kidneys, there are surgical teams that stand by with pagers ready to move at the drop of a hat. And they, you know, they have to go straight away, and they're out there so often in the middle of the night getting organs, preparing them, and getting them ready to save someone else's life. And so, yeah, there are teams standing by all over the world, really, on any given day, ready to go and you know, get these life-saving organs.
You talk in the book a little bit about the first successful face transplant in the USA, and this seemed even more complicated than a sort of standard organ transplant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an incredible thing, really, the first full face transplants, because there are both moral and ethical issues, as there always are with organ transplantation, but also beyond that, there are some quite difficult technical issues. And the thing here is that for the vital organs, the risks that you expose the recipient to, the patient who needs the organ, the risks that you expose them to in the process, are kind of easy to rationalize, because without the heart, the kidney, the liver, the lungs, they will die, and they will die soon. If you're requiring a transplant, you are urgently in need of some help. And yet with the transplant of a face, you know, it's not a vital organ, it's not a life-saving intervention, and yet you still expose the person who's receiving that donation to a lot of the same risks that they're exposed to in any other organ transplant. And so, you know, part of the thing is, you know, whether or not those risks are in proportion with what the person stands to gain. And I think for quite a long time, perhaps the community thought, well, this is aesthetic, and not life-saving, and so perhaps the line is drawn there. But then you look at the detail of the cases of people who are disfigured for whatever reason and who need this sort of a reconstruction which is so extensive that just simply moving blocks of flesh from other non-specialized parts of the body, so, you know, skin from a thigh or skin from the abdomen up onto the face, isn't going to be enough. When you realize how fundamental appearance is to the quality of someone's life, what it means to them, what it means to their family. And when you read the stories of these people who've received partial or full facial transplants, you realize that, you know, this may not be life-saving in the obvious sense, but certainly in terms of the benefits to the patient, the risks are well worth taking.
You talk in the book a little bit about some of the earlier experimental surgery on hearts, but I'm wondering, how does modern medical ethics deal with new and dangerous medical procedures? Is it different than it used to be?
So, yes, I think that we're slower now than we used to be. The sort of mid-20th century was quite an incredible time of very, very rapid advance. And I, in fact, I had the pleasure of interviewing, as part of the preparation for the book, Terence English, Sir Terence English, who was the cardiothoracic surgeon who did the first successful heart transplant in the United Kingdom. And he says that speed at which we went from never having operated on hearts before with any expectation that anyone would survive to transplanting the first human heart, and that, you know, was a period of just short of 20 years. He says that if that happened today, if we didn't have human heart transplants today, it's unlikely we would have them in 20 years' time because we've slowed down. And then the question is that a bad thing? Is that a backward step? And the answer is almost certainly not, because, you know, we did many terrible things in the 20th century because we didn't consider too carefully the ethics of what we were doing, and that enormous question that's always presented to science, technology, and the practice of medicine, which is, just because you can do a thing, does it really mean that you should? And so I think in general, in medicine, certainly we've slowed down, but that's necessary for it to be safe, for it to be properly considered. And, you know, you have to make those trades. And so do you want massive quantum leap type advances that ride roughshod over the human rights of individuals? I don't think you can say that that's a position, a society in which you want to live, really.
You mentioned heart surgery, and heart surgery is one of those things today, while, you know, still dangerous, it seems kind of commonplace and even a bit routine. We really forget we only figured out how to do it successfully pretty recently. And it was interesting in the book how many sort of casualties of that experimentation happened.
Yes, and it's interesting, isn't it, that when you read the sort of bare facts of the early days of cardiac surgery, you think, gosh, these guys were real mavericks, because for the pioneers of this, and when we're talking about the early days of cardiac surgery, really, cardiac surgery doesn't become an entity in and of its own self until just after World War II. And it's pioneered principally by, in the first instance, it's principally pioneered by a young surgeon called Dwight Harkin, who's an American surgeon, but he's stationed in England during the end of World War II. And he receives and operates on dozens and dozens of injured soldiers with fragments of shrapnel and bullets in their hearts. And, you know, all of these people survive. And then suddenly people realize that the heart is not inviolate, that it can be operated upon. When you look at his experience in the civilian world shortly after the war, and that of his contemporaries and indeed competitors, they have a huge attrition rate amongst the people upon whom they operate. I think between them, Harkin and his most direct competitor, a chap called Charles Bailey, of the first 15 patients that they operate on, at least half of them don't survive the procedure for any length of time. And then you think, well, you know, these guys are butchers. In fact, Bailey was referred to with exactly that word during some of the time of his innovation. But, you know, that's a very simplistic narrative, because as it's been put to me by various people, people were so suspicious of cardiac surgery at that time that no physician would refer their patient to the surgeon for this type of surgery unless there was absolutely no other hope for them, unless that there was nothing else that could be done. And so very often the people upon whom they were operating were already so unwell that, you know, the anesthetic alone might be enough to kill them, let alone the surgery. And so it's not quite as simple as that. It's not quite as simple as saying that these people went out and effectively killed people with experimentation. They were just operating in a sort of extraordinarily challenging environment. I mean, one that is almost impossible for us to recognize in the context of modern medicine today. You know, there's no anesthetist or surgeon who would even think about operating in that environment today, because that's just, our risk profile has moved on, the way that we consider risk and the patients who can accept this risk has just changed entirely. So it's much more complicated than just saying these guys experimented on these people without further thought. I think you have to look into the detail of it and how hard those operations were, and that these were often a cohort of people who weren't going to survive if nothing was done at all.
So I'm curious, how much is the advent of modern anesthesiology tied to our ability to successfully operate on organs like the heart, for example?
one of the great overlooked advances in medicine of the 20th century is anaesthetics. And the anaesthesiologist is sort of the guy who's in the background, who you don't think much of, who the people who write our medical dramas don't see. They hardly see them at all. They don't understand them. So they just relegate them to this sort of twiddling knobs in the background. When in fact, that is all important. And it has formed a platform that's allowed us to mount some of our most daring assaults in medicine, really, to be able to perform these radical and drastic surgeries and to be able to support people with life support machines on intensive care. You need to be able to manipulate human physiology and at the same time render a human being reversibly unconscious. Now, that's an enormous feat. So if someone set you that as your challenge 200 years ago, that you should be able to render someone reversibly unconscious and manipulate their physiology, while then someone assaulted their physiology with a disease or a new surgery, you know, that would make the Longitude Prize just look like a walk in the park. This is nearly impossible, this thing to do. So as it evolves, anesthesia starts in its very dark days from being absurdly dangerous, at least as dangerous as the surgery which is being conducted, sometimes more so. And that's because the chemicals that you're using, the drugs that you're using, have unpredictable and injurious effects on the heart and the breathing. And in the early days of anesthesia, certainly through the 19th century and on into the start of the 20th century, it's not uncommon for people just to die simply of the anesthetic insult alone. And it's not really until we develop more advanced anesthetic techniques, more advanced anesthetic monitoring, and crucially, that we allow doctors to specialize in this area, to specialize in being people who fly physiology, who drive and shape physiology second to second, heartbeat to heartbeat, to keep people stable while these ridiculous things go on. Heart transplants go on around them, lung transplants go on around them, life support continues. Until we make that something that we focus upon and make a specialism in and of itself, none of it is really possible. And yet, the anaesthetist still is always there in the background of all of this stuff and never quite has the spotlight on them. I guess that's probably their character. They're probably, you know, they're content to be sit there doing this vital but almost completely invisible role.
I've heard we don't entirely know how the mechanisms of anesthesiology work, just that certain drugs do certain things and sort of how to control the ride a little bit. Is this true?
There are two types of anesthesia, broadly speaking. There's the one that we inject, the type that we inject into your arm at the start of surgery, and, you know, the anesthesiologist says, count back from 10, and before you get to 10, you're asleep. And we've got a reasonable handle on the receptors that those drugs work on, and roughly, very broadly, what circuits in the brain they're switching on or off. Now, when it comes to the more traditional anesthetics, the inhaled anesthetics, where anesthesia started, which was the inhalation of these vapors that led to unconsciousness, that's a bit grayer. We're not sure precisely the mechanism of action of those agents. And it's not that surprising when you think about it, because, you know, what we're talking here is about the boundary between consciousness and unconsciousness. And given that at this time, nobody is able to give a good definition of what consciousness really is, actually understanding how a drug is rendering you unconscious becomes problematic, because you're actually asking yourself how a drug is producing a state which we can't properly define, either its presence or its absence. And so, you know, it is an odd thing that we use these drugs without, you know, fundamentally being able to reduce precisely what their mode of action is. And it's a funny thing, because they've become so common in use and so many millions of people every day have anesthetics and recover without a further thought. But, you know, if you got on a plane and the pilot said, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be cruising at 36,000 feet a day at about 500 miles per hour. I am not really sure how the plane works, but I pull the stick, I push the throttle, and it usually flies and everyone survives. Are we all good with that? You'd almost certainly get off the plane. And yet that's fairly true of what inhalational anesthesia is at the moment. We know how to give it so that it keeps you safe and it works. Fundamentally, the mechanisms still elude us.
Oh, this is Science for the People, and we'll be right back with Dr. Kevin Fong right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm talking with Dr. Kevin Fong, MD, about his new book, Extreme Medicine: How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. You describe in the book your experience working the aftermath of a pub bombing and the triage process. In a situation like that, how do you decide who gets help in what order?
What you need to do in that situation is work out how to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that involves trying to work out who needs the most immediate help, who needs help but whose lives won't be lost if they wait for a while, those people who are walking wounded who don't need any immediate attention at all, and those, that very difficult category of people who are so severely injured that they're probably going to die of their wounds whatever anyone does. So on paper, it seems very simple. You know, you find out the people who need immediate help to save their life and treat them first. But in practice, it's very hard to make that assessment. And because A, it's not always obvious, and B, it's not entirely, well, it's not in any way devoid of human emotion, that decision. So that's what you're supposed to do. And it's a very, very, very difficult thing to do. And these scenes at the best of times are very chaotic with lots of incomplete information. And so how you get your brain to move around that space is very tricky. I went to a massive pile up on the highway recently. So I'm currently working with an air ambulance team here in the UK, and we had the same decisions to make, and it's very difficult to do that. It's one of those things that you can write on a card in about five lines, but in practice looks almost impossible.
It's interesting to me that some medical advances aren't necessarily about technology or technique, but about procedures and checklists that keep emergency medical practitioners from making simple mistakes in the heat of what must be an incredibly stressful situation.
Medicine has become more complicated and faster. We've been forced to become more procedure-based, and we've railed against that in medicine, I think. I think that we think it is insulting to our professionalism. I think that's the initial way in which that was received. But actually, what we're beginning to recognize is that the medicine today is so fast and so complicated that actually we do have to have recourse to aid memoirs and things that standardize our procedures and make us safer. That, I think, is becoming a much more a prevalent feature of practice in modern medicine.
What do you think today's sort of new frontiers of medicine are? Where are we pushing at the boundaries?
Well, we continue to push everywhere. My conclusion from the book, and you know, writing the book was in and of itself an exploration. What the book was for me was trying to reconcile those two halves of my life, the half of my life that was a practicing doctor in a modern hospital, and the half of my life that loved exploration and the exploration of the physical world. And through the book, I came to recognize them as very similar endeavors, that all of the frontiers, whether they be in medicine or the physical world, were always exploratory efforts. And that for every age, society was defined by the fight that was in front of them at that moment. Now, for us now in high-income countries, what we're facing now is the consequences of our successes in public health and in acute medicine. The fact that now life expectancy in North America and in Europe sits in the ninth decade of life for children born today. Your chances of making it to your 100th birthday, if you're in a high-income country, are like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. So tremendous advances in the expectancy of life. So that presents a new challenge, which is how to protect people so that they live not long lives, but long and well-lived lives. And so some of the challenges coming up are those that concern dementia and how we address that. We have no meaningful treatments for that disease entity at this time. So that's going to be, I think, one of the defining challenges of this generation. I think consciousness still remains the sort of the last dark continent of human physiology, really. It's so elusive, so difficult to comprehend, and it'll be intriguing to see what progress we make in those fields. And then, of course, on the exploration front, there is still the final frontier. And that's, I want to finish with that. The final frontier makes it sound like it is a single frontier. And of course, it's not. Space unfolds, to all intents and purposes, into a space that, as far as human experience is concerned, might as well be infinite. That, you know, there is the moon to return to, there is Mars to finally explore, and there is any number of other objects within our solar system that still remain for us to see directly. And so I think that there's plenty out there left for us to discover. And I look forward to seeing what the fruits of the exploration of this century will bring.
Kevin, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you want to learn more about Kevin or his book, Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century, you can find the links you need in our show notes at our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. Stay tuned, because after the break, we're back with Dr. Sydney McElroy and Justin McElroy to talk about the podcast Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're talking about the science of sound and hearing. We'll talk to Trevor Cox, professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford, about his book Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. And we'll speak to Andrew Wise, senior research fellow at Bionics Institute, about a gene therapy technique to enhance the function of cochlear implants. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Hello and welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Dr. Sydney McElroy, a family physician and assistant professor at the Marshall University School of Medicine. Also on the line is her husband, Justin McElroy, and together they host the podcast Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. Sydney and Justin, thanks for being here.
That's our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for asking us.
So for listeners who've never listened to your show, what is Sawbones about?
Sawbones is sort of a survey of the history of medicine, specifically focused on oddities and failed treatments to some of the really common ailments that we still suffer from today. Usually, some of them we've since worked out.
But. Yeah, especially ways that throughout history we really got it wrong as a medical profession, or sometimes just as individuals, kind of guessing. Some of the big treatments and cure-alls and our misconceptions about how to handle a disease throughout history.
Why did you guys decide to start up Sawbones in the first place?
We had recorded a couple of different podcasts before Sawbones. One was specifically a 2.5 Men fan cast recorded by people who had never watched 2.5 Men until Ashton Kutcher took over. That was called Losing the Sheen. That was our first podcast that we did. And we actually followed up with a TV podcast called Satellite Dish. And honestly, we got tired of watching as much TV as we had to.
Well, and not only that, we got tired of talking about things that we had no expertise on, other than that we watch TV.
Well, you got tired of that, because I'm still doing precisely that.
and also... topics that maybe you would enjoy more if you'd, I don't know, thrown back a few before listening.
Yeah, that was
We wanted to stray into a topic that maybe you could enjoy sober.
And we could record about sober, so it worked out on a couple levels.
That's fascinating. So you guys started out very pop culture from a podcast perspective and kind of segued into science.
Well, it's funny, we had recorded a show, a version of which I think a lot of people could do. And I think with Sawbones, we wanted to really drill down on the show that we were specifically suited to do. And with Sid's expertise in science and health and my expertise in not knowing anything about that, a show where she educates me about that topic worked out pretty well.
It's always easier, I think, to talk about something that you're passionate about anyway, that you're interested in. I was always kind of a medical history buff. I liked old medical textbooks, and it fascinated me to see kind of where we'd come from as a profession. So it was really easy to do the research for this show and to kind of dig into each episode and enjoy doing it as much as wanting to create a good product.
So any personal favorite topics you guys have covered?
I was really a big fan of Mercury ahead of time, which I had to kind of convince Justin was a good topic, because he said, what is about Mercury, the stuff in thermometers? Why? What does that have to do with medicine? And it played a big role in a lot of really bad medicines that we used to use, especially in early American history. I don't know. For me, that was kind of a nerdy favorite. Let me tell you all about all the bad ways that we use mercury. And, you know, President Lincoln poisoned himself with mercury.
I tend to enjoy whenever our show deals with topics that are sexual in nature, and not because it's like scandalous, but I think because it's such a taboo in culture, like throughout time, we never really get together as a society and have sort of a consensus about what is normal and acceptable and sort of like the way we talk about or think about sex. So anytime medicine tries to delve into that, it's so specific to that time period, and it's so individual, I think, just because it's not a topic that a lot of people traditionally, you know, sort of throughout the millennia have felt super comfortable talking about. So that's always really fascinating to see what the conversation was like at that point.
It's really interesting going through and listening to some of your shows on reproductive issues or sexuality issues. I feel like in history, sometimes what we invented to air quote cure those were some of the most creative or maybe strange ways. I always laugh out loud the most at what people have come up with through the ages to deal with things like hysteria, for example.
Exactly. I mean, it really was such a kind of uptight, stodgy approach to people wanted to create a vibrator. they wanted something that was more akin to a toy than anything medical, but it sounds better and it's more socially acceptable if we kind of, you know, paint it under the guise of, oh, this is a medical treatment, this is a medical device. So yeah, I agree. I think that stuff is really hilarious. I get a kick out of that.
It's hard though, because even though those topics are often some of the funniest, and this is hard for somebody who's trying to do a comedic podcast, those topics are the ones that tend to take the hardest right turns into just utter heartbreaking depravity when you see how we've used science and these quote-unquote treatments to marginalize groups that were already sort of marginalized. It always comes out of nowhere. You know, we're having lots of fun, and then all of a sudden, like, oh no, this got really bad really fast.
It's really surprising, actually, to hear how many times medicine went astray in exactly the way you guys talk about on the show, talking about marginalized groups, classes, races. And, you know, we really think today of medicine being this force for good. And it's really kind of heartbreaking to see that sometimes it was used as a force for not good.
That's absolutely true. It's really hard. For instance, when we decided to do the topic on to do lobotomy, on the surface, lobotomy sounds like such a crazy topic that there's a lot of humor there. You know, I mean, the way that they used to do lobotomies with using ice picks and through the nose, and it sounds so crazy and it's gross, and there's all these different factors that you think, oh, this will be a really fun, silly topic. But then when you dig into it, the reasons that they did lobotomy were so, I mean, it really were just people who didn't necessarily fit into the societal definition of normal at that time. And it was such a terrible way to manage mental illness, and then things that were absolutely not mental illness, maybe women who weren't, you know, conforming to social norms, or people who were gay. And you get into the topic, and then after a while, there's nothing funny and you can't laugh anymore. And then it's just kind of marveling at how wrong we were and how sad it is sometimes. Mm-hmm.
And for people who are listening right now, you know, we've just talked about some of the heavy stuff that's involved in this show, but you guys are often really funny, like laugh out loud funny. Was that a conscious choice to bring the funny?
It's literally the only thing that I can contribute. If it's not that, it's not. It's just that in the editing. That's all that I really do. So,
well, Justin is funny, if I can say that. You are funny.
I
think that's the thing that makes it more palatable. I lecture at the med school where I teach a lot, and I found that if I can find a way to present some material that can get really boring really quickly, if I can find a way to present it where it's a little funny or a little, you know, interesting, or to throw some weird facts in there, it always makes people want to kind of absorb it more, so you can learn and laugh. So I think it's a better format, you know, for as far as educating people. I use that a lot, and so I think it works well for our show.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed shows like Stuff You Should Know, for example, or others.
That was a big inspiration for us.
I think. You don't even realize that you're learning because you're having a lot of fun, which sounds like a terrible back of the box quote for a podcast, but I promise my marketing department did not create that. It was my very own being a hack.
Well, what's really interesting is there are other educational-based podcasts where it becomes kind of a conversation between two people about a topic. What's really interesting, I find, with your guys' podcast is you've kind of taken on these two characters. Sydney, you've become kind of the teacher and the person with the knowledge. And Justin, you kind of are the place of the listener. You ask all those questions and give all those responses that I literally am thinking in my head a second before you say them.
We have an advantage, I think, over some other podcast duos, and that we do a lot of listening and talking to each other. And those are actually rhythms that I think we got into when she was in medical school, you know, where she was learning so much and she would have to recite some of it just to study, I mean, in part, but some of it was just fascinating stuff. And like, I have an appetite to learn things like that and almost no ability to synthesize that data or hold on to it in any way. So,
well, it's a great challenge for me too, because
Thank you, sweetheart. That's very nice. Thank you. That's great.
It's great because I like to talk, I like to teach, and I like to tell people about things that I'm interested in. But it's always challenging to try to present information that's very scientific in a way that everybody can understand. So when we do the show, very intentionally, I know everything about the topic going in, and Justin doesn't know other than what we're going to talk about. And sometimes I'll give him a vague idea of what the theme kind of is, but I never give him information ahead of time so that he can, you know, be the voice of the listener and ask questions as they come to him as we go. Yeah. And I think that's a good kind of a good rhythm for the show.
Yeah, it was a very careful construction to keep me from having to do any pre-production work whatsoever.
Exactly.
My ignorance was essential to the product.
Well, it works very well.
Thank you.
You're listening to Science for the People. We've got husband and wife podcasting team Justin and Sydney McElroy on the line, talking about the history of medicine and their show Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. Sydney, you're a medical doctor. Do you think that this has changed or modified or benefited you from the standpoint of your point of view in the show?
I think so. You know, you always wonder the things that you learn in medical school and then that you start to practice as you, you know, go out and actually, you know, do your job in medicine. Do we really know all this? Are we really getting it right? I mean, that's something that I think as a good doctor, you should constantly be questioning yourself and reexamining the information. And so I hope I already was predisposed to do that, but if I wasn't, this show definitely has helped me question and think really critically about things that we just accept as, oh, this is obviously the diagnosis for this symptom, or this is obviously the best treatment for this condition. Now, even things that, you know, we do today that we accept are commonplace, I take a little more critical view and think, you know, down the road, are we going to be looking back at this and thinking how ridiculous? And I think it helps me keep an open mind and view things a little more critically. And hopefully that makes me a little better at what I do.
It's interesting because you actually get to go and look at doctors before you and some of the mistakes they've made. And I guess that maybe helps you try and avoid them yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of it, we see some themes which are, you know, cure-alls, the idea that there is any single medicine or treatment that can fix everything. I mean, and hopefully we know that that doesn't work, but we fall into that trap even today. And then that kind of idea of certainty, the idea that we can absolutely know everything there is to know about one disease, one organ, anything about the human body. It's so complex. I think we have to constantly be humble. And this show does a good job of reminding me of that.
Were you surprised at how many things were kind of categorized as cure-alls once you started to dig into medical history?
I found that shocking. Every initial treatment or medicine or whatever we were looking into, I would just start kind of looking through different cultures and different time periods to try to figure out, well, what did we think it helped with? And inevitably, you find that somebody thought it helped with just about anything. And I think the idea was that we didn't have a lot of, we didn't have a scientific method for a long time. We didn't really know how to, you know, successfully run some sort of controlled trial or experiment. So if it worked for one thing, maybe it'll work for everything else. You know, I mean, bloodletting is a great example that persisted for so long and was used for so many things. I mean, you'd get wounded on the battlefield and lose a lot of blood, and the treatment for that was to cut you and bleed you more.
Oh no.
Which is madness, but it worked for other things, so they thought, well, maybe this too.
We talk about cure-alls through medical history, but I think today there's still an awful lot of cure-alls or potential cure-alls out there. What do you think it is about a cure-all that, you know, makes us grab onto it and hold on for dear life?
I wonder if there isn't some kind of like a magic feather kind of phenomenon. Like if we can find just that one thing that we as humans are able to create or invent or discover, you know, whatever, whether it's synthetic or natural, if we're able to find that, there's this magical element to it that makes us think, oh, well, there's something bigger looking out for us, or maybe there's a bigger force in the universe. This thing that could fix all of our problems has been out there all along. And then I think there's also that attractiveness of, we like to think we know everything.
There's also a tendency that you see with a lot of things that have been classified as cure-alls that they do have some sort of mental effect of some sort. So the perception that, well, I feel emotionally, I feel good. And I think that you can apply that to whatever sort of ailment you might be suffering from, because that it provides that sort of, you know, if you're on opium, whatever problem you have is not going to seem so bad anymore because, sure, hey, you've got opium.
That's definitely, I think that's where we run into it the most. Opium, yeah. Marijuana, alcohol, those, yeah, are the kinds of things. And I'm not a cynical person, but unfortunately, when you're kind of talking about cure-alls, you have to at least think about, at least today in medicine, there's also the monetary benefit, unfortunately, when it comes to, if you have something that you can bill as a cure-all, there's a lot of profit to be made.
It's been one of the challenges with doing the show is that we have focused on medical history, but we've had to fight really hard to not turn it into a show that tries to dismantle whatever people today believe. And that might seem like kind of a contradiction, but it's really important to us that, like, no matter who listens to the show now, they can take something away from it, even if they do happen to believe in a medicine that we right now wouldn't currently, you know, put a lot of support behind. You know, we don't want it to be a confrontational thing. We want it to be fun for everybody to listen to.
It's really interesting. I sort of knew factually, but I didn't really kind of take it to heart how recent scientific medicine really is. I mean, we were scrabbling around in the dark for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the most interesting thing to me is that, you know, it's kind of fun to laugh about how did we use whatever, you know, whatever the newest thing I'm talking about in, you know, the Greeks or the Romans. We love to talk about Pliny the Elder, or as I called him, Pliny, incorrectly for quite a while until a listener pointed it out.
I love Pliny.
And we love to kind of, you know, poke fun because it was such a long time ago. So, oh, we didn't know what we were doing. Everybody was ridiculous is kind of our bias. But then as we move forward with a lot of these topics, we're not really doing anything that, I don't know, makes sense until the late 1900s in some cases. And so it's really fascinating to think, oh my gosh, this didn't change until 10 years before I was born.
I don't know. I think you can overrate the addition to science to medicine because personally, I mean, okay, what did today's cures have? Well, they work. Okay, that's good. But you look at cures like 3,000 years ago, people were applying the humanities to them. They're much more poetic cures that you can find in ancient medicine. It's just, they're just, okay, so they don't work. I mean, if you want it to work, they're not as great, but there's a lovely sort of humanity, I think, to that people tried to apply to medicine back before they understood.
Like the idea of there are things in nature that can fix problems that look the same as parts of your body. So if you crack your skull, you should have some crushed walnuts. Yeah. It is a very beautiful artistic idea. Wrong, but beautiful.
If only it was that simple.
Right.
Yes.
So given some of your research into historical medicine, is there any of today's medicine that you think maybe doctors of the future or podcasters of the future might look back on with the same kind of good-natured dismay?
That was actually something that Justin and I had talked about recently. If we could fast forward 100 years, what would we be talking about? And there are certainly, I mean, it's hard coming from the perspective I'm still practicing these things. So full disclaimer, I'm not judging anybody else more than myself. I think that pain management is an area where we still are kind of floundering. We're still using a lot of high-risk medications and not always very well. So I think that's going to be a big change someday. I think we still are not doing great when it comes to managing psychiatric illness. I think mental health is going to hopefully be a huge area of advancement. We have a lot of medicines that we don't always know what to do with. And there's so much stigma attached still to psychiatric disease that a lot of people don't seek help, or we don't have the proper funding, or there aren't, you know, practitioners in your area. And so those are two big areas that I think we're going to look back on 2014 someday and go, oh, gosh, we still had no idea what we were doing.
Sydney and Justin, thanks so much for being here.
It was our pleasure.
Oh, thank you for asking us.
If you want to know more about the Sawbones podcast, you can visit sawboneshow.com, a link you'll find in our show notes for this episode, available on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.